This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. In which we read the fine print, so y'all don't have to, again, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today. This one is the 16th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Please turn to page 18, would you, of your copies of the minutes of the January meeting of the Federal Reserve that were released this morning, and read along with me now, if you please. You've all got your copies, right? All right, fine. I'll do it for you. Here is the relevant sentence from the Guardians of Interest Rates today. Most participants noted that if inflation does not move down as they expect, it would be appropriate for the committee to remove policy accommodation at a faster rate than they currently anticipate. Translation for the civilians out there, inflation stays high, interest rates go higher faster. I thought that was something you ought to know. The next meeting of the central bank, March 15 and 16. Something else you ought to know, by the way, is that all y'all are awesome. We learned this morning retail sales last month were amazing, up almost 4%, the biggest bump in almost a year. However, comma, have we mentioned inflation? Because retail sales are not adjusted for same. So are y'all buying more or just paying more? Marketplace's Lily Jamali spent the day digging in.
Recent surveys show that Americans are pretty down on the economy right now. But to PNC Financial chief economist Gus Fauché, today's retail spending data tells the real story on sentiment.
Pay attention to what consumers do rather than what they say. They say they're concerned about inflation. They say they're concerned about the economy, but they're certainly not spending like that. They continue to buy a lot more things.
Inflation did play a role in today's retail sales data. The question is, how much? Joe Brusuelis, chief economist at RSM, crunched the numbers.
And what you find is we got an actual jump this month in sales, even once one takes into account rising prices.
A telltale sign, e-commerce sales were up by 15% in January. Inflation did not rise by anywhere near that amount last month, of course. Brusuelis calls what we're seeing now boomflation.
The U.S. economy is booming as it reflates following the shock of the pandemic.
Even with inflation sticking around for now. BMO Capital Markets senior economist Sal Gautieri says today's retail sales figures, combined with a blockbuster jobs report earlier this month, complicate the task ahead for Fed policymakers.
The Fed probably has to move faster than it was planning to cool down demand and cool down inflation.
Gautieri says signs now point to a more aggressive approach to raising rates starting next month. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Among the things that you and me and all the rest of us bought lots of last month, furniture. Home furnishing sales shot up 7.2% month over month in January. Again, not adjusted for inflation. Sales also up year over year. And overall, really, the pandemic has been a boon to makers of sofas and home office desks and kitchen cabinets. But look, don't we buy those things every couple years, not every year? Marketplace's Matt Levin explains why our new normal might entail buying new furniture.
Like a lot of older millennials, Allison Orwig says the pandemic kind of nudged her into full-fledged adulthood. Last year, the 36-year-old had twins and bought a new, bigger home in rural Indiana, which meant
it's time to grow up with the furniture to match the house.
Growing up meant dropping more than 10 grand on a dining room table and patio set and bookshelves that make for a less embarrassing Zoom background.
The shelves aren't going to eventually start sagging like our old ones did because they were pressed cardboard from a big box store.
Replacing shoddier furniture is partly what's sustaining our home improvement binge 2 years into the pandemic. And that includes the emergency furniture we bought in 2020, says Brad Thomas, an analyst with KeyBank.
If you moved or are starting to work from home for the first time during this pandemic, you may have had stopgap purchases that were not a perfect solution.
There are some headwinds coming for the industry. Post-Omicron travel plans may dent furniture budgets, and supply chains are causing months-long gaps between order and delivery. But Joe Derichowski with the NPD Group is still bullish. He says once a living room is updated,
your eye immediately gravitates towards, well, I should update that, or I should change this. It's kind of like eating a potato chip. Once you have one, it's hard to stop at one.
Although someday you will run out of rooms to improve, right? Right? I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Yes, right. On Wall Street today, they were kind of cranky early on, traders were. Then they got less so. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The technical term for a lot of what happens in global trade is reciprocity. Two countries agree on mutual tariff levels or financial regulations or aviation agreements. And it all works pretty well until it doesn't. In the first couple of weeks of January, 44 flights from the United States to China were canceled by China's Civil Aviation Authority, which said that the earlier flights by the same airlines in question, that would be Delta, United, and American, carried people who later tested positive for COVID, so said Beijing. Well, in response, the U.S. Department of Transportation canceled the same number of flights, 44, on Chinese airlines. Reciprocity, like I said, Marketplace's Abri Benishore explains what is going on here.
Chinese embassy spokesperson Liu Pengyu told Marketplace in a statement that there had been a notable increase in the number of COVID cases imported to China, and that triggered a set policy for many China-bound international flights. And he said it was unreasonable for the U.S. to suspend Chinese airlines flights in retaliation. China's view is in line with its zero COVID approach, says Scott Kennedy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
They don't have an effective vaccine. They are extremely worried about what would happen if COVID started to spread again widely in China and the toll that would take on their population, their economy, the Communist Party's hold on power.
The U.S. Department of Transportation and airlines take issue with the way in which China has carried out its policy. The DOT says the country's Civil Aviation Authority is violating an agreement between the two nations on maintaining reciprocal access by air. Former Deputy U.S. Trade Representative Robert Holliman is now president of law firm Crowell & Mooring International.
Stepping on the agreement between the nations on air travel is really unnecessary.
Spokesperson Liu Pengyu said China's procedures for dealing with COVID had been previously accepted by U.S. air carriers. But the U.S. Department of Transportation says China didn't follow those procedures and instead canceled flights wholesale. And so the U.S. did the same. Robert W. Mann Jr. is a former airline executive and now consultant.
You know, it's kind of tit for tat. You cancel ours, we cancel yours. And this has happened on numerous occasions in the past.
U.S.-China flights are tightly controlled by both governments. It's not an open market. So any moves limiting flights for any reason are often met with reciprocal measures. And not just with China, but other countries too, with similar arrangements like Brazil.
What is unique?
Again, Robert Holliman.
Is the unilateral way in which China has sought to kind of stop the flights from carrying passengers without the ability of the U.S. carriers to control what happens to the passengers after they arrive in China.
This is something the U.S. Department of Transportation also complained about. China's government is in charge of approving passengers to fly, not airlines. DOT doesn't believe airlines should be punished for something under the control of the Chinese government. Spokesperson Liu Pengyu says all airlines from all countries were treated equally based on how many positive cases they had. Michael J. Boyd doesn't quite buy that. He's president of aviation consulting firm Boyd Group International, and he says there is a profound distrust between the two sides.
You know, the Chinese will say, you know, we found a number of sick people coming in on United Airlines or Delta Airlines or whatever. I wouldn't believe that for a second.
He believes China may have inflated the number of sick passengers as an excuse to shut down air travel and keep COVID out during the Olympics. On the other hand, Omicron was surging in many countries when these flights were canceled and surging astronomically in the U.S. In any case, the economic stakes are not particularly high right now.
There's no tourists going back and forth between the U.S. and China. Business travel is, you know, pretty much way down. We're arguing about who would get the rights to operate empty airplanes.
In 2016, he estimates 8 million people flew between the U.S. and China. He predicts in 2022, there will be fewer than a million.
Poof, that marketplace is dead.
And not just because of COVID, but because of the deteriorating relationship between the two countries. So the U.S. and China are playing, in a sense, on an empty field. Plenty of room for political games. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Live music right now, and for the past couple of years, to be honest, right? It's a confusing place. A couple of weeks ago, Adele said she was going to postpone her residency in Las Vegas because of COVID. Coachella, on the other hand, is coming back after 2 years without any mask or vaccine requirements. You throw in local and state requirements, and if you're running a concert venue, it can be tough to keep up. Last year, about this time, I talked to Toby Park. She owns XBK. That's a concert venue in Des Moines, Iowa. And things were, at that point, not great. So we got her back on the phone for an update as she approaches pandemic year three.
You know, things were getting pretty okay. I mean, as you were probably aware, we worked very closely with the SBA, mm-hmm. with the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program, and our venue was a recipient of that program, which really helped us get through the hardest parts of the pandemic. And we had a pretty solid fourth quarter until the Omicron wave came through, which really sort of put us back what felt like almost in square one where we were in March of 2020. We are just now reopening after actually being completely shuttered for the month of January. Reopened last weekend to some success. So we're looking positively forward.
One of the things I learned about the concert ecosystem, I guess, when we spoke a year ago, was that you're sort of, you know, Des Moines as a physical location is kind of between like Chicago and Denver and Minneapolis and, you know, bigger cities. And when they were having problems, you sort of de facto were having problems too. Is that still the case?
It absolutely is still the case. I mean, you know, the tough part about this is even though the entire industry has done a lot to do our best to keep artists on the road and to keep our businesses open, you know, there's not much that we can do if somebody in a tour party gets ill, right? So we're still a bit in that space. You know, the local and state restrictions are not quite as daunting as what they were sort of at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, most everything is open, but it's now really just trying to manage, you know, the artist cancellations and trying to keep artists safe so, you know, they don't get sick and so they can stay on the road and keep us all going.
How have you been able to keep this going as a business proposition? Because I'm going to get, well, first of all, you were closed most of January, right? So you're not getting any revenue, but you still got to pay the rent. So I'm guessing that comes out of, you know, whatever reserves you have or eventually your pocket. I'm going to guess that crowds have, you have been packing them in, I'm sure, the past year. So, I mean, are you like, is this all on your credit card or what's happening?
You know, we, as I said, we were very lucky to be able to access the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program through the federal government. And that really kept us afloat. And, you know, without the support of, you know, our legislative allies and the support of the SBA getting that money out to venues like ours, you know, we would have been shuttered. We are fortunate that we did have a little bit of a cushion to manage the downfall for, you know, late December and January, but it's still something that we're facing. And, you know, even though we're open now and we can be open and, you know, consumer confidence is still a bit waning. We're hoping in the next coming months, as you know, we sort of get through a bit of the thick of Omicron, that things will get better. But it's still hard. So, you know, we're just taking it day by day.
Did you ever think about shutting it down and just walking away?
You know, myself personally, no. you know, if you might recall, XBK opened in September of 2019, so we were only open for 6 months before the pandemic hit. And you know, when you put your life savings and your love and your heart into something, it's hard to let it go. So, you know, no, I never considered shutting it down. And you know, I was always confident and had the support of, you know, the team of allies of other independent promoters and venues around me to help keep me going.
Well, good luck to you. Toby Park, she runs, owns, actually, XBK, and it's a concert place in Des Moines. Toby, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Kai. I appreciate it.
Coming up,
they're going to see the word free, and the word free is powerful.
Sure is. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 54 today at 10%, 34,934. NASDAQ down 15, also a 10th, 14,124. S&P 500 gained 3 points. That's basically flat, 44.75. Lazy Boy released earnings today. Disappointing earnings, I should modify that, citing supply chain issues. Shocking. As a result, they reclined way back, 17.2%. 135,000 tons of avocados have been exported to the United States from Mexico over the past 6 weeks, but that is it for a while. The U.S. has suspended imports of Mexican avocados after a U.S. inspection official there got a threatening phone call. Did you know that Mexico exports 80% of its avocado crop to here? Also that avocados are technically berries? Well, now you know. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Continuing now with our promise to read the fine print so you don't have to. Let's get back to that January retail sales report that Lily Jamali was telling us about earlier. Clothing and apparel sales up almost 22% from a year ago. Online shopping with non-store retailers, that is to say no brick and mortar, up 14.5%. That becomes relevant when I tell you we're about to talk about Stitch Fix and how the way we dress has changed over the past 2 years and what that means for a company whose business model is online shopping with non-store retail, those subscription boxes that are the Stitch Fix calling card. Elizabeth Spaulding took over as CEO of Stitch Fix last August. Ms. Spaulding, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks, Kai.
What's it like to take over a company in the middle of a pandemic?
Well, it certainly wasn't what I was expecting. You know, first of all, I had been at the same place for the first 20 years of my career. So it was already a pretty big change and really exciting to be joining a company that I really deeply believe is the future of how we will all shop and how we'll find what we love. You know, consumers started shopping very differently, very rapidly. And what COVID did was it allowed us to start to bring even more value to that experience for each of our clients. But I certainly wasn't expecting things to change and move so rapidly when I took on the new role.
Well, so look, not to make this all about me, but I'm a pretty good case study, right? Because I was a Stitch Fix shopper for a while, and then the pandemic hit, and I didn't need nice clothes anymore. I didn't even need, like, business casual clothes. I just, you know, none of us did, right? And oh, by the way, I would bet, and I don't know you from Adam, but you probably were not dressing up to go to work in front of your Zoom every day, right? You were wearing, at least on the bottom, sweatpants and slippers. What do you do with that when you run a company like Stitch Fix?
You know, I think one thing that we were fortunate with Stitch Fix was we weren't just nice going out clothes. We definitely had to change the inventory and make changes of things we had bought and that were already in our warehouses. But a huge benefit was we saw that signal with each fix we send, we get very specific input. And so we saw a 10x increase right away in work from home requests. We saw requests for just comfort and cozy. that allowed us to actually move probably faster than many people because we saw that signal so rapidly. Yeah, definitely was wearing the sweatpants and the leggings. I think I have more leggings in my wardrobe than I ever thought I would at this point.
Right. No, look, I hear you. Would you be offended? Just, you mentioned it a couple of times now, the information you have, the signals you got, the data you have. Would you be offended if I called Stitch Fix for all that you do for fashion? You guys are kind of a data company, yes?
You know, it's a great point that you bring up, and I think we're incredibly proud of how data-driven we are, and it's really the marriage of the art and the science. Here's a fun data point, just to the point of data. Yeah. You know, we have a widget in the app called Style Shuffle. Clients essentially thumb up and thumb down items in our catalog or even things we maybe used to have, we don't have anymore, but it gives us a great sense of what they'll love. We have over 10 billion of those data points.
Wow.
Over 1 million clients play that every month. Within 2 days of any new item entering our product catalog, we test it in there. We know who's likely to really love that item. And so, yeah, we really are a data company combined with, I like to think, a very deep relationship company because of our stylists.
All right. So look, what's hot for 2022? Any hints?
Well, you know, not surprisingly, we're in the midst of a great, you know, everyone's saying there's a great reshuffle in talent. There's also a great refresh in clothing. We hear about 2/3 of our consumers saying they're ready to swap out clothes, maybe replace a whole third of their wardrobe.
Wow.
We talk a lot about business comfort. I don't know
business comfort?
I think people, to your point on everybody wearing sweatpants during COVID, people got used to being a little more comfortable, and now they want to look good, but they still want to be comfortable.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're wearing right now, Kai, but hopefully it's a polo, not a button down. We're hearing polos are trending right now with our clients.
Oh, is that right? That's so funny. So it's khakis and a t-shirt. I mean, it's LA, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, tees and graphic tees are definitely on the rise as well.
Oh, that's good, because it actually happens to be a graphic t-shirt. So look, now where do you go? We are at this, we all hope, reopening phase. Consumer tastes have shifted. You have shifted your company in a lot of ways. What are you looking at for 2022, not fashion-wise, but business-wise?
A big focus of our last year and a half has been helping clients not just experience what we've always called the fix. That's our classic model where you tell us some information, then we send you 5 items at a time. We've moved into what we like to think of as our on-demand era in addition to that fix where you can, you know, open up our app and shop your own personalized store at any time. And so really, our future is about being this destination that, you know, helps you get dressed every day, makes it more about the discovery and fun of shopping versus all the hard work, which we think is still the problem with traditional e-commerce and one that we're just really excited to solve.
Elizabeth Spaulding, she's the CEO at Stitch Fix. Elizabeth, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Depending on where you live, the deadline for filling out the FAFSA, that's the free application for federal student aid, well, it looms, that deadline does. A lot of students, though, they just don't. And so they're missing out on billions of dollars from both the state and federal governments. Last year, just half of high school seniors filled out the FAFSA. That is down from 61% of them in 2017. So there is a growing trend to make filling out that form a requirement to graduate from high school. More than a dozen states either have laws in place already or are thinking about it. And there are other plans afoot to get the money to kids who need it. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that.
Filling out the FAFSA can be awkward. It asks students a lot of personal questions, like how much money their parents make.
In the United States, we're just not accustomed to talking with other people about how much money we earn.
Pamela Bennett is the author of Parenting in Privilege or Peril, How Social Inequality Enables or Derails the American Dream. She said those conversations are especially hard for kids who are the first in their family to go to college, and that schools can make them easier.
Some schools have what they call a FAFSA night, bring parents to the school and just have a night dedicated to completing the application.
They can also have a hotline students can call or text with questions. Bennett points to a few in her home state of Louisiana.
Thank you for calling the Louisiana Office of Student Financial Assistance.
Louisiana was the first state in the country to create a FAFSA mandate for graduation. And paying for hotlines or other student support is key to making these mandates work. says Bill DeBond with the National College Attainment Network.
If we're just throwing the policy out here but not supporting it, that puts undue pressure on school counselors and all the other stakeholders who assist students with college going.
In states with FAFSA mandates, the number of students applying has gone up. In Louisiana, FAFSA completion increased by nearly 26% in 2018, the first year the requirement was in place. But because these policies are so new, DeBond says,
whether or not those students actually pursue higher education from there is still an open question.
DeBond also says states should make it easy for students to opt out of the requirement. Others say states should follow the lead of Tennessee, which offers free community college as an incentive to get students to fill out the form. In other words, fewer sticks, more carrots, says Sarah Goldrick Rabb. She leads the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice at Temple.
They're going to see the word free, and the word free is powerful.
As of now, Tennessee has one of the highest FAFSA completion rates in the country. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which is a little bit, hey, you kids, get off my lawn, and a little bit, maybe he's got a point. Charlie Munger, best known as Warren Buffett's sidekick at Berkshire Hathaway, did an event with Yahoo Finance today and was asked, among a whole bunch of other things, what he thinks about cryptocurrency. Now, Munger, who is 98 years old, is already on record as very anti-crypto. But today he said, and again, this is him, not me, he said, this is a quote, it's like some venereal disease or something. Said it ought to be banned. Hey, you kids, get off my lawn. Holy cow, we got to go. Too much me talking today. Got to find your own economic context today, I guess. My apologies. Our media production team is Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.